In the fall of 1994, Timothy McVeigh was enraged. At Waco, federal agents were involved in the deaths of 76 Branch Davidians, including 25 children. President Clinton was tearing guns out of Americans' hands with his assault weapons ban.
I was going to do whatever I could to wake people up and help people fight, because this is wrong.
McVeigh turned to The Blueprint, his favorite novel, The Turner Diaries. He was going to do what the protagonist Earl Turner did, start the revolution with a truck bomb at a federal building. But that was easier said than done. How do you design a bomb? How do you assemble the ingredients? And where exactly do you set the bomb off? McVeigh devoted months of his life to answering those questions. In the fall of 1994, McVeigh and Terry Nichols were living together in Kansas. The two friends were eating at a Pizza Hut when McVeigh looked up from his food and noticed something across the street. There was the entrance to a quarry.
We had been living there, going to Pizza Hut, for 3 months, sitting right next to the quarry, and we had never seen it there. Terry might have and not have mentioned it, and I never saw it. I thought, holy shit, and so I told him, let's jump in the car in the middle of the night and do a recon.
McVeigh thought, hey, that quarry probably uses explosives to create gravel. By this point, McVeigh had been experimenting with different bomb formulas. When McVeigh wasn't staying with Nichols in Kansas, he was occasionally living in an apartment in Kingman, Arizona, near his other army buddy, Michael Fortier. The Arizona desert was the perfect place to set off fertilizer bombs without drawing much attention.
They didn't really know what they were doing. They never done it before, and they practiced to try to get things exploding.
Scott Mendeloff is a former federal prosecutor who specialized in terrorism cases. Mendeloff was part of the team that prosecuted McVeigh.
To make a ammonium nitrate bomb, you didn't just mix the proper amounts of the fertilizer and the fuel. You needed then to make that mixture explode.
Through books he borrowed from a public library, McVeigh determined that the ideal proportion for an improvised bomb was 50 pounds of fertilizer to a half gallon of fuel. He made sure to memorize that ratio. But out in the desert, McVeigh discovered that he was missing something.
And the thing they needed more that was more powerful is a kind of explosive, which looks like a Jimmy Dean sausage container. And you needed to have that in the mixture, which would create enough force and enough explosive power to then act as a catalyst for the ammonium nitrate fuel mixture to go off.
The problem was that those kinds of explosives are expensive. All this ran through McVeigh's mind inside the Pizza Hut when he noticed the quarry across the street.
We jumped in the car some night, saw there was a big-ass trailer there and little steel safes where you store explosives, so if it blows, it doesn't hurt anybody. We decided, let's go for it.
At 2 a.m. on October 2nd, 1994, in the middle of a rainstorm, McVeigh and Nichols slowly drove into the quarry. Along a hillside, they came upon two steel-reinforced sheds.
Back then, you know, security in this country wasn't what it is now, and there was very little security at that quarry.
Using a drill that Nichols had brought along to break the locks, the two men took 300 sticks of dynamite and 350 pounds of blasting caps, otherwise known as detonators. The next day, they drove west to get as far away from the scene of the crime as possible. They wanted to store their loot near Fortier's place in Arizona. Near Amarillo, Texas, McVeigh was almost rear-ended by a trailer. His trunk was full of explosives. A crash would have set off a massive blast, but the vehicle missed the road warrior by inches. That near accident was just one example of all the things that could have stopped the Oklahoma City bombing and saved 168 people. On the surface, the bomb that destroyed the Murrah Building seems kind of simple. Two unsophisticated guys built a truck bomb using relatively easy-to-find ingredients, then blew it up. But when I began looking at those consequential months leading up to April 19, 1995, and saw everything that McVeigh had to do to prepare, I had no idea how complicated it all was. I'm Jeffrey Toobin, and this is Homegrown. Episode 4, Go For It. McVeigh and Nichols settled on one goal right from the start. The bombing would take place on April 19, 1995. That would be exactly 2 years after the end of the Waco siege and the anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord in 1775, the so-called shot heard round the world. To McVeigh, the date would prove his patriotic bona fides. And it was about 7 months away, just enough time to prepare. In the back pages of the Spotlight magazine, McVeigh and Nichols found an ad for a phone card. Though they had no reason to think that they were then being monitored by the federal government, the two men wanted to make sure that their communications couldn't be tracked.
They thought they were being careful with it because they used fake names and cashier's checks with fake names to purchase the calling card.
Nichols and McVeigh made 685 calls on the Spotlight card. The record of those calls would provide a complete diary of the two men's travels and contacts in the lead-up to the bombing. Much of the bomb assembly happened in Kansas. That was the state that Prosecutor Scott Mendeloff was assigned to cover.
They were familiar with Kansas because they had both been in the military in Junction City, Kansas, at a fort there, Fort Riley. And accordingly, that they felt very comfortable in that area.
Using a fake name, Nichols made two purchases of 40 50-pound bags for a total of 4,000 pounds of fertilizer. They also obtained several dozen 55-gallon barrels. Some of them were free from a milk cooperative, and the others were $12 apiece from a hardware store. Continuing to use fake names, McVeigh and Nichols rented storage sheds to hold it all. One big question was whether McVeigh and Nichols could pull this thing off by themselves. Should they recruit other conspirators? McVeigh had someone in mind.
Fortier was an army buddy of McVeigh's. He was in basic training with McVeigh and Nichols, wasn't close friends with Nichols, but was close friends with McVeigh.
In the later investigation, prosecutor Eitan Goldman focused on Arizona, where Michael Fortier lived. Eitan spent a lot of time with Fortier.
He is actually a really smart guy. He was like a chess champion as a child. He was a drug addict. That got, you know, worse and worse after he got out of the army. I think initially he started using because he, you know, screwed up his back and he was in a lot of pain, but quickly became an addict. He shared some of McVeigh's political beliefs. He was a libertarian. He was worried about the New World Order, but he didn't share all of it.
In the dusty town of Kingman, near the Nevada border, Michael lived in a mobile home with his wife, Lori, and their young daughter. The Fortier's politics were a kind of free-floating paranoia, often involving government surveillance. But Mike and Lori's main interest in life was getting high, and conveniently, their dealer lived in the trailer next door.
Lori was a couple years younger than Michael. She's actually also a really bright person. Also, you know, did crystal meth, wasn't, I guess, as big an addict as Michael. And she was somebody who McVeigh, I guess, trusted enough to confide in Michael in front of Lori.
While crisscrossing the country in the Road Warrior, McVeigh would make frequent stops to visit the Fortiers in Arizona.
I think McVeigh's just pretty aimless and doesn't have a ton of friends. And so, you know, Fortiers is one of them. And he was someone who McVeigh thought that he could convince to join him in, you know, planning and perpetrating the bombing. And so McVeigh was keeping him apprised chapter and verse of pretty much all his plans.
Soon after the robbery at the quarry in Kansas, McVeigh drove back to Kingman. Using the Spotlight phone card, McVeigh called Fortier and told him to rent a couple of lockers to store the explosives. Fortier agreed, but he didn't follow through. McVeigh then stopped by Fortier's trailer and made a concerted effort to enlist his friend.
And there's a conversation where McVeigh says, well, you know, what's it going to take? What's it going to take for you actually to pick up a gun and take up arms against this oppressive federal government, New World Order? And Fortier says, it'll take a UN tank in my front yard.
The tank was a reference to a conspiracy theory that American sovereignty was being destroyed by nefarious international organizations.
If there's a UN tank in my front yard, at that point I'll pick up a gun.
Despite that, Fortier would continue to have the role of a quasi-participant in the bombing conspiracy. McVeigh would talk about his plans, and Fortier would listen and sometimes offer suggestions, but he never actually did anything to move the plan forward. McVeigh talked about the bombing project incessantly. One day, while Michael was at work, McVeigh sat in the Fortier's kitchen with Lori.
And he took soup cans out of Lori Fortier's pantry, and he arranged them in the shape of a V.
McVeigh put 15 cans of soup on the kitchen floor. Each can represented a 55-gallon drum with the fertilizer and fuel mixture. Lori asked if he was really going to use that many. McVeigh said yes. This would do the most damage.
So he had kind of the soup cans arranged in this kind of arrow or triangle type thing, pointed at the hypothetical building.
What did Lori think about this?
I think it was a combination of things. One was, McVeigh's kind of a big talker. I don't really believe that he's going to do it. And one was just kind of acceptance. You know, a lot of what Michael and Lori Fortier did was just kind of passively listen to McVeigh and not really react. And, you know, on some level, I think when the bombing actually happened, even though McVeigh had been talking about it for months and giving them detailed descriptions of how he was going to do it, at some level, when they, you know, woke up on April 19th, 1995 and, you know, saw the news that it had actually happened, they were shocked.
Despite all the detailed planning for building the bomb, McVeigh was curiously disorganized about one important thing, choosing a target. McVeigh told Fortier he never considered duplicating Earl Turner's attack on the FBI building in Washington, D.C. McVeigh had never been to Washington, and he knew that security would be tight. Besides, he was more interested in the heartland, to shock and motivate the masses of ordinary Americans. Fortier suggested the IRS offices in Prescott, Arizona. McVeigh scoffed. He wanted something higher profile. McVeigh had visited the federal building in Little Rock, but it had a wide-open plaza, and he didn't think he could get the bomb close enough. Fortier talked about the federal building in Phoenix, but that didn't look right either. McVeigh was about to head east on a scouting mission with Nichols to find racing fuel as an ingredient for the bomb. He planned on checking out two other possible targets, one in Dallas and the other in Oklahoma City. McVeigh and Nichols stopped at a racetrack in Topeka, but the fuel salesman grew suspicious and they left. They heard there was another racetrack near Dallas, a straight shot south on I-35. About halfway through the journey, the highway passes through Oklahoma City, so McVeigh and Nichols stopped to check out the federal building there. Leafing through the local phone book, they found the address of the Murrah Building. Nichols made two slow circuits around the building in his pickup, and McVeigh liked what he saw. The front was wide open, with a cutout in the curb which would allow him to park a truck very close. Continuing on to Dallas, McVeigh and Nichols didn't know where the other potential target was. When they stopped for directions, they checked the local phone book. It appeared that there was no single federal building in the city. That settled the issue. The Murrah Building was the target. But there was a problem. If McVeigh and Nichols were going to pull this thing off, they needed a lot more money. Fast. and there was only one way to get it.
The gun shows were a major resource for these guys, which people don't focus on and should.
McVeigh prosecutor Scott Mendeloff.
The gun shows were a milieu for these right-wing people who were willing to go outside the contours of the law. So one of the people that McVeigh met at a gun show was Roger Moore.
Roger Moore was much older than McVeigh. During the Vietnam War, he sold patrol boats to the Navy. He made enough money so that by the late 70s, Moore never had to work again. So he turned to his hobby, ammunition. Moore started a business called the American Assault Company, and he traveled the gun show circuit. Moore first met McVeigh at a gun show in Florida in early 1993. He was impressed with the young man's military service, and seeing his shabby merchandise, he felt kind of sorry for him. So Moore bought an electric clock in the shape of Texas for $5, and they agreed in a casual way to stay in touch.
McVeigh toyed with telling him more about what he was doing. There's no evidence that he ever did, but there was evidence that Moore was a, in the parlance of today, an alt-right kind of guy.
A few months later, as the Waco siege was happening, McVeigh ran into Moore again, this time at a gun show in Tulsa. Again feeling sorry for the kid who seemed to be sleeping in his car, Moore invited McVeigh to his ranch in Arkansas for a little while. Roger Moore thought McVeigh would help out around the ranch, but he didn't seem interested in doing chores. Instead, they talked politics. McVeigh's rage about Waco seemed to make Moore uncomfortable. McVeigh later described the visit to his lawyer, Stephen Jones.
Moore was exceedingly interested in only the money. Didn't give a damn about why he was selling it or what other people thought. He was preaching freedom and the freedom to sell, but in the end, he was a dictator himself. He was kind of a prick.
McVeigh was a crank. Fundamentally antisocial. This was why he had so few friends. He had only arrived in Arkansas on a Sunday night, but by midday Tuesday, McVeigh announced he was leaving. Still, he would long remember that Moore had a lot of weapons, gold, and cash in a house with little security. Later in 94, with the plan for the bombing fully underway, McVeigh and Nichols had money problems. They were spending thousands on gas, motel stays, fertilizer, and racing fuel. McVeigh suggested that they rob Roger Moore.
He's pricked me a few times. He deserves it. He's rich anyway. The fat fuck.
According to McVeigh, Nichols loved the idea.
He bit hook, line, and sinker. Wanted to go for it.
Thinking that Moore would recognize him, McVeigh enlisted Nichols to execute the mission solo. On the day they planned for the robbery, McVeigh went to a gun show in Akron, Ohio, so that he would have an alibi. Prosecutor Eitan Goldman.
Nichols went out there, and he knew that Moore was by himself, that his girlfriend was away. I think McVeigh told him that. And McVeigh had, you know, sketched out Roger Moore's house, and it was pretty remote in Arkansas.
On Saturday, November 5th, at around 8:30 in the morning, Roger Moore had just woken up and he was wandering toward his barn. Before he reached the door, a voice called out to him from behind, "Lay down on the ground." Moore turned around and saw a man in full combat gear.
He had a ski mask on and he, I think, was wearing a bulletproof vest, and he had a shotgun with some kind of attachment on it to strangle someone, like a garrote or something like that.
The weapon could kill in several ways. With the garrote placed around a victim's neck, the wire could slit the victim's throat, strangle the victim, or the gunman could just pull the trigger and blow off the victim's head.
And Nichols, you know, told him to lie down on the ground, and he tied him up. Moore was, you know, terrified.
Nichols then duct taped Moore's eyes, and he started collecting all the things McVeigh had told him about. Nichols took around 50 pre-Columbian jade statues and gold dolls from Costa Rica, a box of gems, 1,000 ounces of silver coins and bars, gold eagle coins worth $3,000, $8,700 in cash, and 76 guns that could be resold later on the gun show circuit. The robbery took about 90 minutes.
I mean, the bombing was not that expensive, right? It doesn't cost that much money to rent a Ryder truck and, you know, buy a bunch of ammonium nitrate, but it added up. And, you know, they used the money to live, and they used the money to buy ingredients.
By the time Moore finally wriggled free of his bindings, Nichols was long gone. By late 1994, McVeigh was energized. The Moore robbery gave him some extra confidence that the bombing was actually going to happen. On the other hand, Nichols seemed almost traumatized by what he had done to Roger Moore. He had never before committed a violent crime or fought in a war. The two men laid low, hoping that any heat from the robbery would dissipate. And then McVeigh and Nichols more or less stopped communicating with each other. There was even one moment when it seemed like Nichols was backing out altogether. Nichols went to Las Vegas to visit his son and ex-wife. He then used some of the proceeds from the robbery to buy a plane ticket to see his current wife, Mara Faye, the mail-order bride, who was on a visit to her native Philippines with their daughter. On November 22nd, Nichols' ex drove him to the airport. As he got out of the car, Nichols pointed to a brown paper bag on the floor. He said, "If I'm not back in 60 days, open it and follow the instructions." And then Nichols flew out of the country. The next day, despite Terry's instructions, his ex-wife opened the package anyway. Inside, she found a letter addressed to McVeigh, providing instructions on how to empty all the storage lockers in Kansas. A note said, "You're on your own. Go for it, Terry."
If you put them on the spectrum of commitment, and I mean commitment to killing innocent people, McVeigh stood alone.
Larry Mackey was the lead prosecutor in the case against Terry Nichols.
Nichols is, famous for saying, I really got cold feet as this thing unfolded. And he, in fact, took some affirmative steps late in the action that would demonstrate that he was getting a little bit worried about whether McVeigh was going to be silly enough to, in fact, blow up a building with innocent people inside. While he was doing that, the one thing he wasn't doing was picking up the phone and calling the FBI or anybody else to let the world know what was headed down the street.
McVeigh knew that he couldn't sell all the guns from the Moore robbery by himself. There were just too many. With Nichols seemingly out of the plot, McVeigh decided again to recruit Michael Fortier as a partner. He took Fortier and the Road Warrior on the familiar 1,000-mile-plus drive from Arizona to Kansas to pick up the guns. The bombing was about 5 months away, and during the long drive, McVeigh filled Fortier in on the details of the plan.
And then he tells him, okay, it's going to be the Oklahoma City Federal Building, and the reason for that is that the orders for Waco came out of there.
Prosecutor Eitan Goldman.
And then Fortier and he do a detour into Oklahoma City, where he shows Fortier the building that he's targeting.
After a four-hour drive, McVeigh and Fortier made two slow circles around the Murrah Building, and they stopped at a nearby parking lot. But Fortier got nervous, so McVeigh drove a few blocks to a quiet alley. McVeigh laid out the plan for Fortier. He said that a few days before April 19th, he and Nichols would park a getaway car in the alley. Then McVeigh and Nichols would head back to Kansas, rent a Ryder truck, and mix the fuel oil and fertilizer, the bomb, in the bed of the truck. On April 19th, McVeigh would drive the truck to the Murrah Building, light the fuse, and walk to the getaway car. What does Fortier think about this plan?
I think he's got mixed feelings about it. I mean, first of all, he's completely drug-addled. So it is hard to figure out a coherent, mental narrative for Michael Fortier in that time. Part of him is horrified. I mean, he at one point says to McVeigh, "Well, you're going to kill a lot of people here, and not just agents. I mean, what about like secretaries?" And McVeigh analogizes to stormtroopers in Star Wars. He said the individual stormtroopers may or may not be bad people, but they serve an evil empire, so, they're collateral damage.
From Oklahoma City, McVeigh and Fortier drove to Kansas, where they divided up the guns that Nichols had stolen. Fortier went back to Arizona, and McVeigh drove the Road Warrior to a gun show in Michigan. McVeigh was worried about his friends. He knew that he would need help in assembling the nearly 5,000-pound truck bomb. The job seemed too big for one person. McVeigh later told Stephen Jones what he had told the Fortiers.
I told them, children may die. There may be a pregnant woman working there, or there may be someone walking down the street, or someone may have taken their child to work with them. Do you understand that? And Mike said, yeah, I know. It's part of life. But reality hit them more than they thought.
It seemed that his co-conspirators were not willing to make the ultimate sacrifice for the bombing. McVeigh thought there were times when Terry Nichols seemed more interested in money than in the cause, and he did have two kids that he wanted to watch grow up. Fortier, in his way, was devoted to his wife and daughter, and in any case, he never followed through on anything. Could he count on Nichols or Fortier? Were the two of them more trouble than they were worth?
As Mike fell out, and then Terry fell out, I determined that the best way would be to continue on as the Paul Revere-type messenger instead of the John Brown-type revolutionary.
For his part, McVeigh was more committed than ever to the bombing. But there were moments when the plan could have fallen apart. A couple of months earlier, McVeigh's grandfather had died. Ed McVeigh had introduced him to guns, and the two of them had Tim's only uncomplicated, loving relationship in the family. And then, another disaster. About 30 miles from the Nichols farm in Michigan, McVeigh tried to turn left into a gas station when a pickup truck plowed into his trunk. Miraculously, the blasting caps inside didn't explode, but his car was totaled. The road warrior was dead.
This was actually a psychological downfall here, because it was like the last straw. Because that car had been the only thing I could rely on for 7 years. It was kind of like, this is it. There is nothing else. One of many things like that, like my grandfather dying.
McVeigh felt untethered. He had no one and nothing to live for, except his mission to attack the federal government. So much could have gone wrong for McVeigh and right for the world. His plot could have been derailed in so many ways. Michael or Lori Fortier could have gone to the police. Nichols could have checked out of the plot and done the same. The explosives could have killed McVeigh in an accident. Nichols could have been caught when he robbed Roger Moore. The merchants who sold the pair all that fertilizer and jet fuel could have gotten suspicious and called the police. But none of that happened. By the spring of 1995, all the ingredients for the bomb were in one location, specifically shed number 2 at the storage facility in Harrington, Kansas. The only thing left to do was to stick to the plan. In the final days before April 19th, McVeigh was almost disdainfully casual about what he would do after he destroyed the Murrah building. McVeigh made a couple of half-hearted attempts to reach out to possible allies who might shield him in the aftermath. He even left a few messages for someone at the National Alliance, the neo-Nazi organization that published the Turner Diaries, but no one called him back.
This is hard to pin down in my head. There's a little bit of giving up involved there.
McVeigh's lawyer, Stephen Jones, asked him why he didn't make clearer plans to escape. This is how McVeigh answered.
There is a little bit of, I had nowhere to go, no allies to continue anything with. I would not want to go to a friend that did not know anything about it, because that would put their lives in danger. One thing that never came to me was a purpose after this, beside a solo war, which I did not have the resources for. So, since it did not come to me, I said, let's just let fate play this out. Let's see what happens.
With Nichols' commitment to the bombing up in the air, McVeigh tried to do as much as possible on his own. With less than a week to go, McVeigh had a long to-do list, replacing his beloved road warrior, renting the truck, assembling the bomb, and bringing it to Oklahoma City. McVeigh was going to use cash for the truck rental, but he would need some form of identification, too. He had answered an ad in the back pages of Soldier of Fortune magazine for blank driver's licenses. When the card arrived, McVeigh used the Fortier's typewriter to enter the name Robert Kling. Kling was a real person, a soldier that McVeigh knew in the army, and they sort of looked alike. McVeigh also invented an address in South Dakota and provided a birthday of April 19th as a kind of dark inside joke. To buy the getaway car, McVeigh recalled a Firestone dealership in Junction City, Kansas, where he had once gotten the Road Warrior repaired. At the car lot, the dealer showed him a barely functioning, faded yellow 1977 Mercury Grand Marquis. McVeigh, thrifty as ever, immediately began negotiating the price.
He showed me the old Mercury in the back. He says $350. And I said, can I Jew you down to $300? And he's like, yeah, all right.
Then, to McVeigh's surprise, the dealer remembered him from years ago when he had brought in the Road Warrior.
He said, don't I know you, McVeigh? And I said, yes, Tom, you know me. And then he remembered, and he said, just give me $250. The hell with the $300.
It now didn't make any sense to use the fake Kling license, so McVeigh provided his real ID. To rent the truck, McVeigh found a place in Junction City called Elliot's Body Shop. Using the Spotlight phone card, McVeigh called ahead, giving his name as Bob Kling. McVeigh reserved a 20-foot Ryder truck that could carry 5,000 pounds. On the afternoon of Friday, April 14th, Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols reconnected. They hadn't really spoken since the Moore robbery.
We talked for maybe 2 hours about everything. We hadn't seen each other in quite a while now, about 3 months.
Nichols moaned about money and his strained relationship with his young Filipino wife. McVeigh listened quietly and impatiently.
We talked about Marifei and again how she was shafting him over. And he told me she was back, and my eyes went in the back of my head. Jesus, not again.
Finally, McVeigh asked Nichols, are you in or out? It's difficult to know what Nichols was thinking. His lawyers later argued that he was worried that McVeigh would kill him because he knew too much about the bombing plan. And Nichols was probably in no position to go to the police because he'd have to incriminate himself in all the crimes he and McVeigh had already committed. In any event, the two men made a deal.
We discussed where we would meet again to drop my car off, everything.
They would stick to the plan to drop off the getaway car and mix the bomb together. But as for the bombing itself, on Wednesday, McVeigh was on his own. Throughout the months of preparation for the bombing, McVeigh and Nichols did a lot to try and make the job of future investigators difficult. That's why they used the Spotlight phone card. They paid cash for most things. They used fake names. But those plans kind of went out the window around 4 p.m. on Friday, April 14th, at a motel.
The Dreamland Motel, which is in Junction City, Kansas. I believe it's like 4.7 miles from Elliot's Body Shop.
Bob Ricks was an FBI agent on the bombing case. He was interviewed for the Oral History Project at the Oklahoma City Memorial. As part of the later investigation, agents interviewed the owner of the Dreamland.
Do you recall somebody being in here recently with a Ryder truck? And she said, yes, I did. I had a young man who came in and rented a motel for 4 days. He told me he was going to have a Ryder truck, and I told him where he could park it so he would not interfere with any of the other clients to the motel. And said he was suspicious to her.
The owner of the Dreamland was a woman named Leah McGowan, who was kind of a local institution. She had a thick German accent and a big personality. McGowan kept a tight rein on her place, and she had no patience for loudmouths or deadbeats. Here's McGowan on the local station KWTV.
He was a very regular, nice, neat, young American guy.
When McVeigh showed up, McGowan felt in her gut that there was just something off about the clean-cut guy in front of her.
One, he had a beat-up old Mercury. It said it didn't look like it fit with a guy that he appeared to be. He also, even though she gave him a reasonable rate, he tried to negotiate the rate down. She ended up giving it $2 less than the posted rate and ended up renting the room for approximately $20 a day for 4 days.
Here at the check-in desk of the Dreamland Motel, McVeigh did something just inexplicable. McVeigh had planned to use the name Kling throughout the final days. But that plan had already fallen apart when he bought the Mercury from the guy who recognized him. So he didn't bother anymore. When McGowan asked him his name for the motel registry, he said Tim McVeigh.
I'm sure subconsciously it was like giving up, because I know for a fact giving them a composite was giving up.
By a composite, McVeigh meant a chance for an eyewitness to help prepare a sketch of him. McGowan would remember the suspicious Tim McVeigh.
She put him into room 25, which was next to the office. There was a dividing room between her and the office because she wanted to keep an eye on him because he was not acting normally. It's kind of the way she described it.
After spending the night at the Dreamland on the next morning, Saturday, April 15th, McVeigh drove the short distance to Elliot's body shop. He had already made the Ryder truck reservation under the name Kling, so McVeigh kept that deception going. The owner, Eldon Elliott, asked Kling if he wanted to pay for insurance. Suppressing a smile, McVeigh declined the coverage, telling Elliott he was a good driver. McVeigh then wandered around Junction City for a few hours. When he made it back to the Dreamland around 5 p.m., he was hungry.
I decided I wanted to eat some Mugu Gai Pan one last time, so I called up Hunam. Got used to that in the military.
McVeigh ordered from a Chinese restaurant called Hunam Palace.
Well, the total was $9.25, Mugu Gai Pan and egg rolls. I think Mugu Gai Pan is $7.25. The egg rolls are $2. You can't take out unless you order $8 or more, so I had them throw in the egg rolls.
A delivery guy brought the food to McVeigh in room 25 at the Dreamland. The next morning, Sunday, April 16th, McVeigh drove to Oklahoma City and wedged his Mercury, the getaway car, into the alley a few blocks from the Murrah building. Nichols picked McVeigh up to take him back to the Dreamland. McVeigh had told Nichols that they should both report for duty at 6 a.m. on Tuesday, April 18th, at the facility in Harrington where they had stored the bomb ingredients. McVeigh was on time in the Ryder truck, and he started loading the 5,000 pounds of bomb material. Nichols was a half hour late, and he seemed nervous.
Something didn't sound right in his voice. Whether he was about to back out, had second thoughts, or there was something. Some tone in his voice I didn't like.
McVeigh looked at Nichols and said,
"I started. I'm going to finish. You can help or not."
Sheepishly, Nichols helped. With the Ryder truck loaded up, McVeigh drove north, and Nichols followed in his pickup. Around 9 a.m., they arrived at Geary Lake State Park, where they thought no one else would be around on a Tuesday morning. McVeigh parked the Ryder truck next to the lake, and Nichols came over to help.
We immediately started to mix. I quickly said, "I will be the one to pour the solid fertilizer, and he can do the fuel."
McVeigh had learned that the best ratio was 5 parts solid to 2 parts liquid. As he had demonstrated for Lori Fortier with the soup cans, McVeigh arranged the 12 barrels in a V-shape in the cargo bay, with the tip pointed toward the passenger side to focus the blast. Nichols used the same drill from the quarry robbery to make 2 holes in the back of the driver's cab to the cargo bay. McVeigh then threaded fuses through the holes.
Terry nailed down some 4x4s we had left in the storage also, so that the drums wouldn't shift and slide in case I had to take some turns fast or something. He nailed those down. We were then done.
They finished at the lake around noon, and Nichols had parting words for McVeigh.
He then said as we were leaving, he said, "You know, I found out something today. Mary Faye is leaving. She's going back to the Philippines." And I rolled my eyes, and he said, "Well, this time she's going back for good. We've decided to end it." I said, "Well, that's too bad." And I don't know what part of his psyche that would have played in, but he offered that information to me. I said, "Okay." We shook hands. He said, "Good luck."
McVeigh drove the truck south toward Oklahoma City. 30 miles out from his destination, McVeigh spent the night of April 18th inside the cab of the Ryder truck in a McDonald's parking lot. On the morning of April 19th, McVeigh was already awake by the time the alarm on his watch buzzed, and he started driving.
I was trying to drive about 55 to 60, not being too conspicuously below the 55 miles an hour speed limit, but trying to save a little time. took I-35 to I-40 to I-235.
McVeigh had planned to detonate the bomb at 10 a.m. to maximize the deaths of federal workers after they had settled into their offices. But he made it to Oklahoma City faster than he expected. He recalled a Firestone dealer a few blocks away from the Murrah Building.
I parked the truck, turned around in my seat, used my Bic lighter, and lit the 5-minute fuse.
McVeigh put in a pair of earplugs and pulled a black cap low over his forehead. It was almost 9 a.m. When he was half a block from the Murrah Building, he stopped at a red light. To McVeigh, with the fuse burning, the traffic signal seemed to take a very long time to turn green. When it finally did, he eased the truck into the small indentation in the sidewalk next to the Murrah Building.
I set the parking brake, dropped the key behind the seat so that if any Rambo jumped in the truck or something, he could not get it started or move it or anything. Opened the door, locked it, shut the door behind me.
McVeigh walked at a normal pace toward the alley where he had parked the Mercury.
When I got into the alley, I turned around and looked, saw that no one was following me or no one was watching me, and also there was no one in front of me in the alley. I then started jogging.
Then McVeigh began to worry.
In my mind, I'm thinking, it didn't go off yet. Something is wrong.
McVeigh spied the Mercury in the alley and broke into a jog again. Homegrown Oklahoma City is a USG audio podcast produced by Western Sound in association with Esmail Corp. It's reported, written, and hosted by me, Jeffrey Toobin. Executive producers are Josh Block at USG Audio, Sam Esmail and Chad Hamilton at Esmail Corp., and Western Sound's Ben Adair and Colin McNulty, who is also the editor. Production support from Josh Laulongi at USG Audio. The producer and sound designer is Tyler Hill. The associate producer is Stella Hartman. The producer from Esmail Corp. is Sarah Maddy. Original theme and engineering by Alex McGinnis. Fact-checking by Nicole McNulty and Savannah Wright. Special thanks to Betsy Shepard and Dan Leone. Passages of Timothy McVeigh are read by Chris Cowan. Our gratitude also to the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum and the Briscoe Center at the University of Texas. For more information on this podcast and other podcasts by USG Audio, go to our website, usgaudio.com. And to learn even more, read my book, Homegrown: Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism.